just a general comment just in terms of process and so forth. I think the first thing is just in terms of where we are in the process and with time and so on and so forth. Again, the bill was released on the 31st of July. You guys the Parliament gave a deadline of September 5th, which we got all those comments. We gave them a 29th deadline for most of the bill, but a fifth date for a second batch of the bill. But essentially, we received over 500 comments so far. So we pretty much done 500 comments. We received over 500 pages of comments. Excuse me. It seemed like over 500 comments. But yes, it was over 500 pages of comments. It was quite extensive. I think the comments now are getting a little repetitive. After our hearings that we last met, we agreed that we would meet with the people that you had discussed with before the Portfolio Committee. We had a one-day work session where we went through all of the issues that were raised once again to make sure that we heard all the various technical points and other things. And I think that you will see when you look through this response document, which is quite lengthy, that you will see that we were quite receptive in a lot of these comments, and a lot of things have been changed as a result of those comments. So you'll probably see more acceptance than non-acceptance. There are a few non-acceptance, but mostly things were, we took on board what we could as much as we could. Just some issues around consultation times. I don't want to get to this too much. There's always that question about time, that people would like to have more time. I think that's agreed. I think, though, in this process, we've done better. I think we need to do better as we go. I think there's a lot of things putting pressure on our time. But we did at least give a one-second bite at the apple this round, which we hadn't done before. One issue that kept coming up in some of the comments that was also more general was around the instability of the Tax Act. That we are constantly changing the Act, and therefore is making it very difficult to comply. Let me say that we have made a lot of changes over the last number of years, and we do understand where the taxpayers are coming from. But I think it's important to note that the pressures for change are coming from all sorts of different directions. I think the first thing we need to remember is that we had a tax system that was initially written in isolation pre-94, and life was a lot simpler before we entered the global economy. And a lot of our changes are coming as a result of that re-entry into the global market. Two, tax laws around the world are subject to lots of change, annual change, and we're no different. Part of the reason why that happens is tax law is not based on intent. It's based on objective criteria. If you do X, it happens whether you intend it or not. And the rules around tax are based on objective criteria because it creates certainty for taxpayers. The problem is the economy is changing all the time, so you've got to change that objective criteria all the time. Then, of course, there's the usual anti-avoidance concerns, and then there's also taxpayer requests for change. The area that was cited by taxpayers most was that the reorganization rules are being changed. And I must say that most of those changes are coming at the insistence of taxpayers. I mean, literally every month I'm getting requests for change, and it's typically in the reorganization area, the CSC area. So all I can say is that some of those changes are desired by some. But anyway, we will come back to that later. Last, there was a lot of discussion around effective dates and the timing of effective dates. And I think that the presentation by Ed Liptak was a good one, and I think he was fair in that. He said, look, this is a complex issue. You can't have a one-size-fits-all. I think that the issue of effective dates does need some examination. But again, I do note that taxpayers are often requesting retroactive change. But that said, I think it's something that we need to look at, and I think a policy needs to be developed across the board. And so we will look at that further. Those are just some general notes. Now, we'll start turning to the issues, and I turn this over to Ms. Warden, and then he'll come back to me.
Thanks, Jim. Thank you. Just as a overall rider, we have prepared a briefing for the minister, and unfortunately the minister is abroad, so we still require the minister's approval for some of these particular changes we're proposing. So some of these things are still subject to ministerial approval. We've discussed this with the senior people that he trained me, and we think we're probably on in line with what we inspired. So, the one issue that I will address up front, and then people deal with the next issue, is the issue on retirement.
Thank you. With your respect, I want to hear from you as a matter of process. As I listen to the gentleman saying that there's some of the issues which I don't know yet were the briefing to the minister, and the minister is abroad, if my paraphrase is correct. And is there any time where we'll be given a time to sit, we as a committee sit and look after the minister has looked into them, and maybe there are some changes or no changes? And what are the reasons these things have been brought in front of us? That's the second question. If the minister has listened to them.
Okay, I want to believe that Cecil is talking about two processes here. What the committee in the there's laws allowed before the committee. What the committee and losses. No one unwinds. And if there is any process where perhaps the executive feels that there are issues that might have been endorsed by the committee but that we still are engaging, they will have to be brought before the committee again. They are only of effect once they have been approved by this committee. So I think Susan is saying that some of the things they are proposing to the committee, then they do not have the backing of the political premise. But they are proposing to the committee, but the committee has also said this is a separate process, this is our process. Did you want to say something?
Chair. I hear the chair. I see. I think maybe he can also assist us to highlight this.
Okay.
But nonetheless, of course, when you look at the PFMA, the minister is responsible, not the official. We can't hold the officials accountable. The minister has to be held accountable. But nonetheless, if the committee wants to go on, let's go on.
Thank you, Jack. I think this is a sort of procedural issue that we need to just clarify. On page 3, and I hope you got the comments by now, on page 3 deals with the whole issue of taxation of pre-withdrawal pre-retirement. As the committee can recall, we simplified the taxation of lump sum withdrawals on retirement last year, and we then said we will attempt to do something similar for withdrawals from retirement funds, and we put a proposal to in the Revenue Laws Amendment Bill, and the comments we received was of a nature that we would probably disadvantage certain taxpayers if we proceed with that particular proposal. We ran again some numbers with the chair, and that particular comment has been accepted. What we are now proposing is a slight change to the way we're going to tax the withdrawals. In order to avoid too many tables, we have proposal to incorporate the taxation upon withdrawal with the taxation at time of retirement, the lump sum payment, with the one provider that the 300,000 exemption would not apply in the case of withdrawal pre-retirement. The effect of that would be basically that the first 600,000 rand upon withdrawal pre-retirement will be taxed at 18%, and then 27% and 36% as in the case of retirement. We've done some numbers, and the net effect there is that the taxpayers are no worse off, and some of them might be slightly better off again under the current regime. The current regime takes into account a particular formula which is subcomplex. So that particular proposal has been accepted. And I've got an example if the committee wants to look at it, how the numbers stand up. A lot of the other comments then really are incorporated. The important point that we make also is that the withdrawals, if a person withdraw from his retirement fund more than once, the amounts will be accumulated so that you will be taxed, you know, on an accumulated value. The 1,800 exemption will consequently fall away, and also the other design features of the rebate will also fall away. Okay, I think that covers basically.
Because we're going to try to hit the highlights with big policy issues. Are there a lot of technical lawyer stuff in there, which might excite some of us lawyers, but I think we want to focus on the big policy issues. The next policy issue that came up was the change to pension to provident funds on page 4. And what happens right now, under long-standing law, if you shift this from a pension to a provident fund, that was a tax event. The reason why is a pension fund, you're only allowed to withdraw one-third as a lump sum, whereas a provident fund, you get to pull out all the money as a lump sum. So the pension fund vehicle is a preferred tax vehicle because we want people to save money for retirement and we don't want them pulling out money in lump sums. And anyway, when you shift from pension to a provident fund, that flexibility will give means is that you have a taxation event. What happened is there was a case that we were defeated in, and therefore they allow a free withdrawal between the two, and the law has restored that. People have requested that when you shift from a pension to a provident fund, that should not be a tax event because it remains in the retirement savings world. The problem is that the provident fund gives too much flexibility for full withdrawals. And the suggestion was that we don't have a tax event there, but then we start pushing, give people an incentive to move from a one-third lump sum regime into a 100% lump sum regime. So that was not accepted. We basically have taken the position that when employees contribute to provident funds, there is no deduction, only when they contribute to pension funds. So when you switch to those vehicles, there is a taxation event. The next one is a little outside the bill, and that is on living annuities. And living annuities was not addressed in this bill, but there were just a few technical corrections. Two questions are raised. One, I think, was hyper-technical, and we wouldn't agree with. But the first one is a little bit of a concern. The living annuity has had a long-standing position that a living annuity, you appoint a nominee, and if there is no nominee, then you turn to the estate should someone die when it comes to death. So what happens in the living annuity is if you die, the money goes to a nominee or to the deceased estate. That has been the long-standing position. And the law that we made change to in February changed that balance. And I think it was unintentional on our part, and so we're restoring the law to its previous balance because that's how the agreements have been drafted. So that point has been accepted on page 4. That was the first one we released. The second one is really hyper-technical. Now, turning to page 5, this is fairly big issues around the estate duty. The first questions that came up was the general anti-avoidance rule. We had proposed to put in a general anti-avoidance rule into the estate duty because we've had them in all the other acts. And the complaints about it was that we caused too much disruption by adding it to the estate duty. Now, there were some complaints about the drafting, I think that was conceded, that said, well, you know, you say that the general anti-avoidance rule applies except if you have a business purpose for doing things. Well, in the world of estate planning, you often have family planning that doesn't have a business purpose, but it doesn't necessarily have a tax purpose. But there was some concerns that the general anti-avoidance rule would cause too much disruption at this time, and people requested that we go after some targeted anti-avoidance. But at this stage, we decided to withdraw the general anti-avoidance rule for further reconsideration. We will come back. We do know of some specific issues of concern. One is around formulas for valuation that we need to address. There are also some concerns that in some of the comments they said, you know, gee, we have all the estate freezing techniques where we can basically freeze the estate at an artificially low level. You don't mean to disrupt that, do you? Well, I think we are concerned about that kind of estate freezing technique. But I think what we're going to do is come back with more targeted anti-avoidance rather than disrupt what's been done. So that needs to be reconsidered at a later date. A bigger issue is on the life insurance and retirement savings. Now, we had two proposals in the legislation. One, that the estate duty is...
Can I just check? You know, one of the requests made by the honorable member is that maybe you must actually bring to our attention and then identify those areas where, for instance, the issue of the withdrawal of the general anti-avoidance duty, if it's one of those that even though you have, you know, you are proposing here the withdrawal of the general anti-avoidance duty of the state duty. But this is the one that you seem to not have, but this is not the power, so that when next we meet, the committee can be taken forward. So could you please, you know, mention those that you say this is what you propose, but you just haven't got the final blessing from the committee.
Yeah, I think we'll do that as we go along. I think the general avoidance one, we don't think that's an issue.
Okay.
The first point that you raised on the withdrawal, that's an important point. Yeah. Okay.
On the withdrawal.
And I think the next point that people also raised was
one. Yeah,
absolutely.
as you touch on them, if you could just...
That's fine.
Yeah.
So the first one was the pre-retirement withdrawal. So the second one now is the life insurance. I think that is an issue that we need ministerial clearance on. We originally proposed that when it came to the estate duty, we were going to drop two things. We were going to say all pension savings was no longer going to be subject to the estate duty, whether it was lump sum or not. The second one was around life insurance, but that would be excluded from the estate duty. The decision on the pension funds remained the same. I think we have no problem with that, and that's fine. I think the life insurance one, that became a bit of a risky area. And based on the comments we received, we have decided that we are going to recommend to the minister that the life insurance exclusion be withdrawn. This is what the original thinking was. The original thinking was is what we were trying to promote was to say the risk element of the life insurance could be excluded. That's what we were originally hoping to do, and what we were also trying to get in there is that to some extent life insurance is already excluded if you do certain kinds of planning. But the problem with the life insurance amendment goes too broad, and that is that the life insurance doesn't just pick up the risk element, it also picks up the savings element. And the ability to convert genuine long-term health savings into a life insurance product, especially with the assistance of tax advisors once they see that this exclusion exists, we felt that the amendment would go far beyond what we originally intended. And therefore, we need to withdraw this amendment and for further reconsideration. And that is an issue that we must clear with the minister. So I think that is probably one of the bigger debates that's being discussed here. Moving over to the next one, I don't know if anyone has added anything to that. Is the employer-employee issues. Most of these are smaller on page 6, so I don't think there are too many on there. I don't know if you want to pick those up. There's a number of issues around what happens when an employee gets a bonus and then has to repay the bonus. And the easiest example to think about is maternity benefits. So you leave your job temporarily for a few months, you get 3 or 4 months' salary, and then you decide not to come back. Well, the 3 to 4 months was given to you on the presumption that you would go back to work. And what happened in the old law was, if you received the money, it was taxable, but if you returned the money, you didn't get a reversal of tax. And what we did in the law is we reversed the tax, and that's remaining, and there's no change. But there was a number of suggestions that we go further. And one of the things that came up with is that in the original is that they want to make sure that they get the refund in the PAYE system and not wait till year end and when you have your final return. And while we're sympathetic with giving
a refund in the PayYE system. The PayYE system just doesn't work that way administratively. The PayYE system is designed to take each month separately, and if there are deductions from that month's events, then you can make an adjustment. So for example, if you receive a month of salary and you want to dedicate 15% to pension, that's doable in the PayYE system. But you can't say some outside event outside the salary that's being received should be an offset. So that was one set of rules. There were other sets of issues where what happens if I get the money in the year 2008, but I have to return the money in 2009? And what people were asking for was a refundable tax credit, effectively, or an ability to carry back returns. And while we're sympathetic with some of those issues, the tax system we currently have don't allow carrybacks because that would require reopening the prior returns, which is a huge administrative burden. And frankly, there are very few countries that allow for carrybacks. And so those were not accepted due to administrative grounds. There was one smaller issue, though, that was important, is sometimes you will get a bonus, and that bonus will be allocated as an entertainment or a travel allowance or something else. And the law did cater for return of those sums. And so we are fixing the law to say, look, whether you return the money as actual cash bonus or travel or entertainment, that clearly, if you return that money, you should be able to get a deduction. So in all of those cases, you get a deduction, but there are some timing issues, where sometimes the timing could be better for the taxpayer, and we can only do what we can within the framework of the tax system. So those are essentially what's going on in those cases. There was an odd question around cell phones and cell computers. Not a big issue, but one that confused us a little bit, that we generally have a simplifying rule for cell phones and computers that says, look to your main business purpose, and that's being retained. There were a number of questions to say that we would like all electronic communication equipment covered, not just cell phones and cell computers. But we looked at the law, I think our law clearly envisions all those kind of communication devices. So we wait for a more specific response. Now here's another issue that's a little bigger on page 7, which is the consolidation of deemed employee regimes. And that one is also got to be cleared with the minister. We had originally proposed that a number of anti-avoidance rules be combined. Now we have a number of rules to make sure that taxpayers don't disguise their employee status as something else. And the reason why you want to disguise employee status is you want to get around monthly withholding, PayYE. Two, you might be able to get a better rate issue. Or three, you're also trying to get deductions you're not otherwise entitled to. Those are the main benefits, but PayYE being most important. Now, we have a series of rules to prevent that have built up over time. One is case law. Second is a labor broker rule. And third is a personal service company and a personal service trust rule. What we had proposed in the legislation was to combine personal service company, personal service trust, and the labor broker rules all into one unified regime. And that was designed to help taxpayers. After hearing much comment, most taxpayers felt what we had done was giving them more harm than good. And since we were trying to help them, and they said, well, wait a minute, you're not helping us, we felt that we should reconsider the amendment. So what we are thinking of doing is narrowing the amendment, combining the personal service company and personal service trust regimes together as one, because that isn't causing the problem. But the real problem is combining the anti-avoidance rules for individuals. And so what we're going to do is keep the individuals separate as they were before, and they will remain under the case law in something called the labor broker rule. And the labor broker rule will now just apply to them. So what we've done is we've just simplified the world for personal service entities. In the world of individuals, we're keeping the old law because most people said the old law was preferable. That's essentially what we're requesting here. Issues
on some minor issues on the payroll deductions. There was a question as to whether you were forced to, in fact, permit these deductions through the payroll system. The answer is no. Essentially, if you're allowing them through the payroll system, the tax system expects you to also take account of it for employees' tax. It seems logical. If you're doing it for payroll, you should be doing it for payroll tax. And then The other one was a question as to whether somebody who was on the site system, which applies to people who have a salary of less than 60,000 rand a year, would be able to claim additional donations. And the answer to that is yes, they would, because we made an amendment earlier this year that had been victimized to the line.
On page 9, Mr. Chair, we deal with a few questions around the disability, but I think the response is pretty clear. There is a few technical issues around long term, which we don't necessarily because they're already provision for that. An important question that we will have to grapple with on a continuous basis, and start to a large extent here, is this list that we're proposing. And yes, I think SARS will have the responsibility to compile this list and update it on a regular basis in consultation with various stakeholders. It seems to me to be quite a tricky exercise, but we've committed to that. And obviously, the Department of Health will also be consulted in any other relevant stakeholders. The idea of having broad categories rather than a detailed list is something which we could consider, and we'll have to see how that at the bottom of page 9 is the issue of broad-based employee share schemes. We have proposed a couple of changes there, and one that was raised by commentators was the ceiling that we are upping from 9,000 to 50,000. And there was a proposal to increase even further. We don't think there is at this stage merit to go that far, so we will stick to the proposed 50,000 rand. There was also a suggestion that the 50,000 should not be a hard cutoff, but a soft cutoff, so we should have it in the case where an amount is larger than 50,000 and exclude the first 50,000 all the way. But for administrative reasons, we don't think that is feasible.
So we get some of the bigger issues around the STC. I'm trying to hit the highlights of the STC because it gets very technical. We only have so much time. So again, I'm a little careful, a little worried about my New York way of speaking. So I need to try to slow down, but I'm worried about time, so I'm trying to speed up. So I don't know which way to go. Maybe you should go higher or lower with me. Anyway, my apologies for that. Look, the big issues are, there are a number of issues of clarification around the new conversion to STC, and I think you'll see that in those areas of clarification, I think we generally accepted those. The big issue that's before us is issues around transitional credits, and that's page 10, where it says operation of STC credits and expiring of STC credits. And I think most taxpayers have welcomed the decision to eliminate the potential double charge. I don't think they have any objection to that. There was some suggestion, though, that we could do it differently. That came up fairly late in the game, and that was the way we've given the relief is that you have an old tax on dividends, which is called the STC, and then you have a new tax on dividends. The old tax applies to companies. The new tax applies to shareholders. As we said, there are cases where a dividend will pass through a multiple of chains, that the bottom company will be taxed, and if we're not careful, the top individual will be taxed again on the same profits. What we did is we eliminated the second tax coming on the individual on the same profits. So when the tax is supposed to come again, we eliminate it. But I think there's perfectly legal justification for that. What was requested was, instead of eliminating the tax for the individual, please refund the prior STC for the company. Now, as a matter of law, you could go either way. It's not, you know, one more than the other. But the request was being made because of the issuance of accounting. That right now, STC credits are deferred tax assets. And therefore, if you give the credits and relief to the individual, there is no deferred tax asset for companies anymore. And therefore, this asset disappears. Now, this is an accounting issue. And so there was a suggestion that what we should do is give the rebate to the company and put it into the income tax system. And we did consider this issue. And the problem is it's administrative, because what you need to do then is link the two different systems, the income tax and the STC, into one for auditing purposes. Both systems operate on different timelines, and they operate with different personnel and different computer systems. And so to make the two join as one is going to create a major issue. The second problem also began to emerge was whether we give the credit for the company or the individual was the question of paying exempt parties, and that is paying dividends to pension funds. And if you pay a dividend to a pension fund, there was the question of, do you give SPC credits for that? And clearly, we didn't want to give SPC credits when you pay to an exempt party. Now, there were ways we could do to shift the this, that, or the other, but it started to become a lot more complicated. But unless you gave some sort of relief there, most of those deferred tax assets would disappear in any event. There's a number of issues the taxpayers will raise around those, but again, we didn't want it. We were trying to eliminate a second tax and in terms of SPC, and so that was not accepted. And that was an issue that's going to be raised to the minister, although he's already made the decision under the prior rule, so I don't think there's going to be any change there. But to just note that as it is, but I don't expect any change. There was a suggestion that the SPC credit timeline, we have SPC credits, they are lasting 3 years into the new system. People wanted more time. Most people requested five, one or two requested a limited period. We said, okay, well, we will concede to 5 years. Although we don't, that by the time this bill comes into effect, it's 2 years, so it's really about 7 years now. But we conceded to 5 years, but we want to make sure these things terminate. And I think a 5 year satisfies most of the requests. Okay. Then on page 11, there is a note about a number of collateral issues. Why didn't you deal with foreign dividends? Why didn't you deal with scrip lending arrangements? Why didn't you deal with deemed dividends? And as we said in our initial media statement, the purpose of this legislation is to get the core of the new SPC out so people could do their systems planning. And we wanted to get this out on the table and get all the debates done with this and settle this down. Remember, this law won't go into effect until those treaties are enacted, which is at least a year away. So all of those collateral issues will be dealt with next year, but we needed to get the basics established before we went further. So all those comments are noted, and we will deal with those in the following year. Let's jump over then to the revised dividend base on page 12. There was some complaints about the new CTC system. Again, whenever you change systems, a lot of people who work with the old system will tell you how wonderful the old system is. Until while they're living with it, they complain about it, but when you change it, they don't want you to change it. But there was some complaints that the new CT system creates a new set of record keeping. Because when you have your dividends, the calculation requires a separate tax calculation. The way the new rule works is that every distribution is a dividend unless it comes out of contributed tax capital. They said this requires new record keeping. We didn't accept that comment because under current law, whenever you distribute a dividend, it's got to come out of profits. Now, profits is a company law concept, and that's what all the commentators point to, but the company law concept has lots of tax adjustments. So you start with an accounting company law point of view, and then you make so many adjustments that you're already in a different system anyway. So what the regime is basically doing is saying, instead of focusing on profits, which arise on an annual basis, we will deem everything to be a dividend except the things that are return of capital. And return of capital happens in fewer times in a company's lifetime. And so, therefore, the regime that we've calculated is fairly simple. But there was some questions about the starting point. They said, look, when you have the starting point, 2009, we want to start with the old system. And I think we've agreed with them, start with the old system. We're not sure if there's that many differences what we proposed originally, what they had. But if it was comfortable, we said start with the old system, and what is envisioned is all the companies are going to have to put their starting point on their returns for their first return when the new regime goes into effect. And if they don't put that on their first return, then they will potentially lose their CTC. That issue is still being worked out. But I think most taxpayers wanted that transitional starting point on page 12. Big concerns around foreign investors on page 13. And one of the questions about CTC was that when it came to foreigners and exempt people, that when you made a contribution, say, you know, 50,000 rand or whatever you contributed, that the old rule gave you a zero contribution. Clearly, they said that was not intended, and we agreed that was not intended. That when you enter the tax system for the first time, we will give you a full fair market value contribution into your CTC. Now remember, just for those who don't love corporate tax as much as others of us who do, is that CTC is basically your contributing tax capital, which means you can pull that out, and when you pull that money out, it's not subject to dividend tax. It might be subject to capital gain, but it will not be viewed as a dividend. So what we're saying is, if you're a foreign investor and you put in 50,000 rand, pulling out of the 50,000 rand will not be viewed as a dividend, is essentially what we're saying. That dealt with the bulk of the issues. There were some complaints around Section 42, because in the 42 we give you a rollover CTC, which is if you have 100 value and a 20 base cost, we only give you a 20 CTC. And there were some complaints about treble taxation. We didn't feel that those issues were as large as taxpayers felt, and we also said, look, you have a rollover for everything else, this should also apply to rollover. But one thing became clear in the discussions is that the 42 rollover regime, taxpayers don't want it to be a full rollover. And they've suggested that we want to move to a UK system. I think that issue has to be taken up at a later date. I think there's serious avoidance issues around there, but I think that's something we may have to discuss at a later point. Without going too far, let's see here, just to jump through stuff fairly quickly. There were some questions again around CTC about cancellations of loaded services on top of page 14. And they said if we contribute not cash, but we cancel a loan or we provide a service, clearly that's the same as the market value of contributing an asset. And we agreed with the taxpayers, and we felt the current law provided that. We still believe it provides that, but we'll clarify that in the explanatory memorandum. Let's see. Let me carry forward a little bit. You will hear my voice a little further. There are issues around declarations and refund periods. Now, what we've designed is a system where the company is going to withhold the tax. So if the company pays a dividend to individual shareholders, the company does the withholding, and if there are problems, the first port of call is not with SARS, but is with the company. We felt that was actually better for taxpayers. So you don't have to deal with the administrative arm. But the problem is some companies don't want to deal with that administrative burden. Now, that is the one downside of the new STC, that the old regime was fairly simple. But the complaint of the old system was it was simple, but it wasn't fair. Now, if you want, you always have a choice in the tax system. Do you want simplicity and unfairness, or do you want fairness and complexity? Well, this system is more complicated, but it is a lot more fair. Your pension funds are now exempt. Your foreign parties will get tax treaty relief. Those things are viewed as more fair. But that suddenly makes the world a lot more complicated because under the old regime, all dividends were taxed at 10%. It didn't matter who the shareholder was, except for there was a roll-up on companies. But as a general matter, the company system is different. Now the system takes into account the different parties. Well, that's a lot more work. Now, this system, unfortunately, requires a lot of declarations and a lot of things in order to make sure the people who say they are exempt are truly exempt. We tried what we could. We had a lot of discussion. We actually had an international consultant on this. What we basically adopted was a simplified system based on a number of other world systems we used. And we tried to make this as simple and as painless as we could. And we actually met with a number of the parties who were involved on the JSC, all the, I guess they're called CSDPs on the JSC, which is something called regulated nominees in the bill. But basically, just to show you just a few of the complexities, when a listed company pays a dividend, you think that dividend directly comes to you. It doesn't. It goes through a series, it goes on to the Straits system. The Straits system has a series of CSDPs, which is AFSA, Nedbank, all the other banks, brokerage firms. And by the time the money has gotten to you, it has gone through multiple hands. And that calculation is what causes all the complexity. But what we tried to do as best we could is to simplify it. We met with those industries, and they felt this was the simplest way of dealing with it. But we do admit there is some complexity here. But there's not much we can deal with there. But to some extent, it's in technical issues as we go forward, we are very sympathetic to those. There's an issue around page 15 of the director officer liability. I know that they can mistake this, so I have to explain this.
Essentially, what we do is if the company does. Remember, we're dealing with nominees in the chain now. So a nominee can be a company that in fact has very little in the way of assets in it. I mean, it could have 1,000 rand worth of share capital and 1,000 rand in the bank, and then holds all these other shares as a nominee for the true owners. Now, it has the responsibility of withholding tax under certain circumstances. And what happens if it doesn't withhold the tax? Well, the company is liable. But the company's got a whole 1,000 rand available to it to settle the liability. Because the shares that are sitting in its bank vault, or in the safety deposit box, are not its shares, they belong to other people. So in order to ensure that there is some recourse here, and that people don't abuse the system of nominee companies in order to essentially defraud the fisc of withholding tax, we say the directors become personally liable if the company can't satisfy the debt. Okay? That concentrates the minds of the directors, or not all the directors, I should add. It's the director who's most closely involved in the financial affairs of the company, and therefore has the most likelihood of knowing what's actually going on. Certainly concentrates the mind to know that you need to be sure that you're deducting it properly. Now, there's a complaint that goes too far, and we have some sympathy with that, and so we'll be carving back on that particular sort of secondary strict liability that exists with respect to the essentially the financial director of the company. Or if the company is perhaps a close corporation where you don't have such a thing as a director, essentially the shareholder who's most closely involved in the financial affairs.
Thanks. Appreciate that. I think that's it on the withholding issues. Again, I think we're going to probably see, as time goes on, when people have to live with the new system, I'm sure we're going to have a number of small anomalies on the withholding. As taxpayers are sitting down and actually putting their systems in place, there may be technical issues around that, and those will have to be presented to us for whatever changes require. But I think we try to make the system as seamless as possible. The issue that was quite emotive was on page 16, the state of passive holding companies. And so we thank the committee's intervention on that. We heard a lot of interesting comments. Some of the comments were, this regime is completely unnecessary, and it's going to seriously impact upon us. And then at the same time, they said to us, well, none of us have any of these things, so why are you worried about it? So we kind of had a different set, and then we heard that there was no problem, but then when we saw the rate differences, there was a problem. But needless to say, there was a lot of emotions around the whole issue. We did discuss with the industry the following in our one-day work session. I think what we did was we tried to get really where the areas of concern were for the taxpayers. But as a general matter, we're retaining the regime. That is to be kept the same. That was what is on page 16. There were some complaints also that this is nothing like international jurisdictions. I think if you look around internationally, they all have passive holding company regimes, and they were all slightly different. Ours is slightly different as well, and that's just the way it is because every system is slightly different. But it's not like this is something new internationally, so I'm just mentioning those small points. There are a number of anomalies that emerge, and you see that on page 17. One is, why should foreign companies be subject to passive holding company regime? At first you'd say, well, they should. The answer is they really shouldn't, because they have a different set of anti-avoidance rules, our favorite CFC rules and other things. So they will be excluded from the regime. And to the extent there are foreign company cross-border overlaps, we have eliminated those. So that's that. We've also suggested that the test can be simplified. The real worry here is domestic individuals. And so the regime is only going to apply where domestic individuals own more than 50% of this passive holding company regime. And that will probably clean out quite a bit of issues. On the bottom of page 17, we're worried about treasury operations. Now, we had a rule to make sure that an active company that has a financing arm should not be affected. Those rules were a little too subjective. Taxpayers wanted a different rule. They were suggesting that when you look at the group, you look at it as a whole. And if the whole group is active, then this treasury operation should be exempt. And so we've accepted those comments. There is, I think that's all there is to be said on that. There is the one that popped up actually late last week that we're going to have to deal with, which is dealing with broad-based employee share schemes and the BEE deals. And a number of the BEE deals are done where you actually have a special purpose vehicle. I guess I'm saying SS, it's just a special purpose vehicle. Where that entity collects money and then gives it back to the company. And it appears that that entity is also hit by this thing, and clearly we have to fix that. The idea is self-financing should be taxed. This is not a tax-motivated thing. So that is something that we are going to pull out from that regime. The other one that seemed to have popped out is there was a number of concerns, and I'm jumping around a little bit in here, but you'll see that first, let me go to the bottom of page 18. There was some concerns that the passive holding company regime was going to tax capital gains at 40%. Now, we didn't read it that way. We were looking at it very closely, but capital gains was never part of this regime. Companies are taxed 15% on capital gains. Individuals are taxed on 10. There's no arbitrage where the companies are actually worse off there. Whatever suggestion was in the legislation to the contrary, that will be removed, and if people had trouble reading it, we'll put that in the explanatory memorandum. That actually knocked out a bunch of other issues for people. I think people were just reading the legislation. But there was some concerns that there might be some estate planning, not tax planning, but true, genuine estate planning. There might be a few other situations where this regime might get caught up. Now, when we came back to the taxpayers and said, look, we can't just ask for some sort of might be. If you have specific facts and circumstances, we welcome those, present them for us, and we will be glad to consider them. This regime will only come into effect in a year or so from now when the new dividend tax comes into effect. So we still have time to make a change before this comes into effect. And that's where we are on those issues. One other point was that a number of people have asked for two kinds of transitional relief. I'm trying to find out where they were in this comments here. This is really on the page 18, the second comment, where it says, if the new passive holding regime is enacted, certain companies may suddenly find themselves in trouble. Please give us transitional relief. That's that comment. And what they're asking for is, if I find myself in this regime, well, I want to get out of it. I didn't plan my way in it. So please let me have a tax-free liquidation. Now, at first blush, that seems very reasonable. Give them a tax-free liquidation. The problem is, if you give people a tax-free liquidation, they get around the corporate double tax. And you might find that people will plan themselves into this regime to get the transitional relief, then to liquidate. Now you say, well, that's a little far-fetched. Remember the funnel schemes and other things, not very far-fetched. So people will suddenly use an anti-avoidance rule as a sword, whereas we plan to have it as our shield. So we're willing to look at specific facts and circumstances as they arise, and we always are willing to do so. We have a year in which this is before this goes into effect, and so let the taxpayers come forward before we enact something as radical as a transitional regime of that nature. Okay, company reorgs, the degrouping charge on page 19, there was technical issues around that. I think we're going to clean those up. The point purpose is not to have a double tax, and I don't want to say too much about that, but I put that more because there's a few lawyers. They always want to know that that's being dealt with, and we might have to shift that draft around a little bit to make sure it exactly works. There is no policy issues there. There was a little bit of emotions around the election. In order to come in with the reorg rules currently, in order to get rollover relief, you have to elect in. But 90% of the taxpayers automatically want to elect in, and now they have to file elections if not needed. So we reversed the election, and we said, well, the 90% don't need to elect in, but the 10% need to elect out. Well, of course, all the people who have to elect out are now complaining because now they have to do something. Most of the people who want to elect out are foreigners because they don't want to be in this regime and exempt parties. So what we're going to do is make sure those people don't fall within this regime because they never want this regime in the first place. So that should solve most of their problems. We're talking about foreigners with foreign assets, not foreigners with the establishment. I saw a face over there. So, thank you very much. But we actually try to help them, so trust us that we will do that. So that's it. The Sherrish anomalies, I think we don't have time on that one. And it's pretty small technical issues. On page 20, intellectual property arbitrage. Now, remember last year there was this 23I, this anti-avoidance rules for intellectual property. We held off the legislation for a year. We have narrowed it. Taxpayers appreciate that we've narrowed it. But the big issue came down to 1 year. There was a one rule, the two-year rule. And the two-year rule says that if intellectual property is developed in South Africa, and then it goes abroad, and then South Africans are charged within a two-year period, we feel something's fishy going on. And most taxpayers felt this was too broad because they said, look, it could be any South African, any foreigner, and any South African recipient. And in the committee, we said, we understand that rule is overly broad, but the problem is if we make it narrower, we're going to run ourselves into trouble. Well, having churned and churned and churned, we believe that we can narrow this rule to basically two scenarios. And we're hoping that we do this right. One is there are certain Baer Davidian schemes where people strip the underlying Baer Davidian from the profit elements in the world of intellectual property. It's a very narrow set of cases, and we will deal with that. Those are also concerned in other areas, but at this stage we're only dealing with this one. And the second one is where you have a single trade. And that trade, let's say, is the business of selling liquor. And they sell, whatever it could be. But let's say it's just beer. I don't know why I've got beer on my mind. Maybe it's just what I was thinking about last night. But the point is that it's a certain brand. And what happens is you want to deal with that, and that's the trade that you're in. But we want to make sure if that's your beer business that you don't transfer the intellectual property with that beer business and then that trade is charged for that intellectual property. So say, I don't know, what is beer going for? It's 5 grand a beer or something?
Can't you remember what it was last
year? Yes, I did not spill. And maybe that's why I'm beginning to get incoherent at this point. But the point is, let's say it's 5 grand a beer, well, all of a sudden, you have the intellectual property, and what will happen is the trade will then be being charged maybe 2 or 3 grand a beer. So instead of making 5, it's now making 2. What we want to make sure is that the trade and the intellectual property stay together. And what the concern was is that that trade would stay the same, but the intellectual property would go abroad, and then the South African trade would be charged for it. The difficulty we had in the income tax law. Income tax is about entities, not trades. And what people do is they shift the entity around, but the trade remains the same. What we're trying to do is design a rule that says that going concern can't be charged for the intellectual property that it's always had. So if that beer business has always had that intellectual property, you can't charge it against it for that same intellectual property separated. The problem is that people disguise that trade in different legal entities. We want to make sure that those legal entities don't matter. We look at the underlying trade. So we were going to try our best on that one. And we'll give the taxpayers what we want. Let us hope they not avoid it so we come back with a technical correction. And let's hope we draft it properly so we don't have a technical correction. So I watched that net space closely. That will not be easy drafting. I think that's the biggest issue around intellectual property, except for the last one. And that actually generated a lot of comment, which is around control of foreign companies. Now, under current law, if you have a foreign entity, all royalties are fully subject to deemed taxation under 9G, our famous CFC rules. All royalties, whether they're active or passive. And we did that to protect ourselves. That is an old standing rule that's been going on for 7 years. About a year or two ago, we said, we will soften that rule if you go before and get a ruling from SARS. Now, no SARs rule has ever been issued on this. I'm not making a criticism, I'm just saying no ruling has been issued. I know that there's been some recent requests. What we did is we put in a rule that said you can request an active royalty exemption if, in all cases, except if you charge South Africa for the royalty. And there was a lot of criticism around that rule. What we've come back is we've said, look, when it comes to the active royalty rule, we really don't think that should be left up to rulings. It's very difficult to decide the policy issues. It becomes a policy issue and not an administrative one. So what we are proposing is a prophylactic rule that says active royalties as a general matter should not be a ruling issue. If you have an active royalty, what we mean by an active royalty is one where you're continuously enhancing, developing, servicing, sort of like a computer software package, where you're sending out your technical personnel on an ongoing basis. That is an active royalty, and therefore, that is not passive income artificially shifted offshore. And what we've done is we've generally limited that to when you're getting those royalties from foreigners. There is also potential for double taxation if you have a royalty going from South Africa to a foreign jurisdiction, and we're eliminating the double taxation. That eliminates most of the cases of prophylactic law. There is still a request to say that if you're a South African group and you take over a foreign subsidiary, a foreign entity, and that foreign entity always charged you a royalty, can I keep that royalty in place? I think that one we'll have to look at. I'm not sure whether we can accommodate that one. This stage is narrow, but we are still open to some discussion. Probably separating the good from the bad. Now we turn to small business.
All right, small business, or as we probably will be redubbing it, micro business. Interestingly enough, not a large amount of comments on this one, which I think displays the focus of some of the commentators that come before the committee. What's their bread and butter as opposed to what some other people's bread and butter is. That said, we did get comments, and we had informal comment that we specifically sought. And so we'll just hit on the highlights here. One of the comments that did come before the committee was that we should extend the regime to so-called professional services. Now, we looked at this one long and hard, and we are not accepting that proposal. We're proposing that we not accept it. Because, well, twofold. The first is we have a simple, single tax table at the moment for small micro-businesses. And once you start bringing high margin professional services into the system, the question then must arise, should we have a separate table that takes account of the fact that these businesses have a higher profit margin than is typical for other businesses? And so you then go down the road of having two tax tables for micro businesses, one for people who are in the service industry and one for people in other industries. Now, that may not sound like a huge issue, but of course you then have to set appropriate rates, and it took us a fair amount of research to set the appropriate rate for the sort of combined table we have at the moment. And second of all, you then have the issue of what you do with someone who does a little bit of professional service and some of other services or activities as well. You start running into marginal issues. So something that you've intended to be very simple starts becoming quite complicated. So that's one set of issues. Another set of issues, of course, is that people who are in professional services tend to have to keep fairly accurate records because they're professionals and doing professional work. I mean, an optometrist who can keep your prescriptions noted down so that the next time you visit you can track just, you know, what's happened to you, would probably be in trouble. And so if you're keeping good detailed records for your professional services, the question then comes to why can't you keep basic accounting records for the accounting aspect of it as well. So based on those two, we have not accepted the idea of bringing professionals in. What we are amenable to is to looking at some of the marginal issues and some of the tweaks with respect to the definition of what a professional service is, and that we can work with people going forward. Turning to page 23, just a quick quickly go over two of the issues there. There's a question, since we've just been talking about dividends, taxes, and STC, as to why we cap the STC or dividend tax exemption at 200,000 Rand. Why can't I take as much dividend out of this little business as I like? Well, where did you get all this profit that you want to take out of the business is the question I would ask. And one of the obvious ways you could have gotten this profit is to take what used to be quite a large business that you owned, scale it down so that it becomes a small business, and then strip all the profits out of it for your STC and dividends. That's why you need a cap. And the cap is set at a level that if you're hitting it, then your profit margin is probably very, very high, or you've got retained income that you're bringing forward. And so that it's entirely appropriate that you're actually be subject to the STC and the dividends. And then last one, a very practical issue with respect to record keeping. We're asking you to keep track of your assets and liabilities over 5,000 Rand. People are saying, well, 5,000 Rand is very low. Well, fair enough. We looked at it again and decided that 10,000 Rand would probably do the trick just as well. Why do we ask you for your assets and liabilities? Well, so that we can see that your size of your assets and liabilities is consistent with the profits that you your turnover that you declare. Because if you have something with massive assets, massive growth in assets, but a very low turnover, again, the question must arise, how did that happen? How did you manage to grow your business from something that had 100,000 rands worth of net assets to 1 million rands worth of net assets, but you've only got a turnover that year of 400,000 rand? Something doesn't quite gel. So it's really just there as a bit of a control measure, and we are looking only for the larger assets. We're not asking you to look after every tool and laptop computer that you have. Which then takes us onto the venture capital company regime, which is on the other side of how to help smaller businesses.
Okay. Thanks, Ron. So just to close up on the micro business example tax here, I think it's important to note that we're trying here to reduce the compliance burden of the tax system for the very small business, and not necessarily to reduce their tax liability. And I think to some extent, some businesses will have a slightly lesser tax liability. It's a coincidence, and we try to design the table to be reasonably fair. Now you get the obviously, people would like to say, but I'd like to get in the system, not because it reduced my compliance cost, but because I have a reduction in my liability. That is exactly what we are guarding against. The venture capital one is, as I mentioned earlier on in the previous discussion with the chair, one of those issues where we're very careful to look at tax incentives because it really goes against the grain of the blood. We like to do in terms of keeping tax systems. But there are exceptional cases, and this particular event intervention appears to be one of those. Just a small point at the bottom of page 23, there is the possibility that a venture capital company might be caught into this passive holding company regime. There was never the intention, we clarify that, so that we don't undermine what we start wanting to do. The issue of the limits that we're setting for the venture capital fund or venture capital company, remember we've got two regimes here in place. One is for general small and medium-sized businesses and mining exploration companies. And because of the nature of these two slightly separate animals, we have two different thresholds. Some commentators feel those thresholds are too high. We at this stage think we could live with those thresholds. We want to put a benchmark here, not to allow anybody into the system that can come and do a few funny things here. So those thresholds, for now, we will retain. There is the issue of the time period that a venture capital will be required to spend the money into an investing company. We've got 18 months as a suggested period. People feel that it's too short. And we think in the case of mining in particular, they might have a case, and so we propose it to increase it to 24 months. The other important restriction we have here is that it's only applicable to natural persons and listed companies. And there's a particular reason behind that, because we have a cap associated with the investment by individuals into this particular vehicle. And if we don't have this particular restrictions,
and you allow unlisted companies and trusts to also invest here, that monetary thresholds will become redundant and people will find various ways to undermine it. And important is that we have to have some restrictions so that one can have some control over the nature of the tax that we will store for this account. We, on the bottom of page 24, we have a 10% restriction on a company investing into this venture capital company. In terms of the allowable deduction that the company can get, it's important to know that we don't restrict a company to only invest up to 10% in the VCC. The only restriction we have is that you can only get deduction for up to 10% of that investment. And the reason why we have that particular proposal is to ensure that you have a broad range of investors into the VCC. There's nothing prevents the company to invest more, but it's just the deduction will be limited. On coming to page 25, there was a concern that because we have provided that the income from a venture capital company must only be financial instruments, this is a point that we've overlooked. The issue of management fees is an issue that is a natural part of this business, and so we accept that particular recommendation. The middle towards the end of page 25 was the 80% requirement to be invested into companies with a gross asset of less than 10 million. A technical correction there is the gross asset value and not the market value. So it will be the book value of the company and not the market value at the law is at the moment. However, we are not accepting this particular proposal. The intention here is really to provide equity finance in the area where it's perceived to be lacking, and that is at the bottom end of the market. And so the extra 20% would provide that cushion for companies to spread their risk. To go beyond that, we think you would undermine the objective of this particular exercise. So we stick to that. On page 26, the permissible invested companies, the definition of permissible invested companies is narrow, dealing with property related things. Here we accept, partially accept it. We will try to accommodate the investments into the quantum type of activities, and so we'll make sure that we amend that particular one. At the bottom of page 26, the 40% requirement of a VCC into an investment company, there was a feeling that that 40% is too restrictive, and we accept it, and we think 49% would probably do. We would, however, guard against a VCC obtaining controlling interest into a particular company, because that would also be problematic. Other, there was concerns about the relationship between the company owner and the VCC fund manager, and we think those particular arrangements can be done outside of this particular ownership requirement. Just to note that we've added two issues which we raised. One at the briefing, Mr. Chair, is that in addition to the existing legislation, we will also introduce a overall lifetime limit, just to make sure we've got some control over the incentive of 3 times the annual amount of 750 as a deduction. However, if you sell your shares, you can, and there's a recoupment that goes with it, you can replenish that particular, so that you can sort of evolve that particular. Also, we're proposing a sunset clause with most of our incentives, or all of our incentives these days, that this incentive will run out in 12 years' time, obviously with the possibility of extending if it's working, and then we have a compulsory review period by year 10. And the reason for a reasonably long period is that we think it will take some time for this to get off the ground and to get sufficient information to evaluate, and that's why we have a fairly long period. The issue that was also raised and we grappled with right at the beginning was the regulatory framework for the VCC. Currently there is no particular regulatory framework in which it fits. the VCC will have to apply to SARS for approval, and there was certain minimum requirements that they have to do. Therefore, we had put that particular monitoring threshold for fairly high so you don't have too many people trying to jump into a system that has got no solid regulatory framework in place. However, we are in discussion with various players, specifically with a unit within the Treasury, to look at the regulatory framework. And one possibility is to house it within the current collective investment scheme. We've explored that, but we don't have sufficient time to do the legislative amendments, and so maybe within the next 18 months or 24 months, our financial sector policy unit will come to you with some proposal about the regulatory framework for the people. That with respect to VCC. Turning over to the next section on page 27 deals with housing allowances, depreciation for residentials and UDZ. We are proposing a few amendments in that respect. You see the one issue that was raised by some of the municipalities in some place was the occupancy certificate as a requirement. At this stage, we have noted it. However, we await from the municipalities to come up with an alternative because the occupancy certificate is problematic for existing buildings. For new buildings, that's not a problem because it's a requirement for existing buildings. Then there was a small confusion about the existing 100 square meter requirements for the UDZ areas and the 5 minimum units for residential units. We clarified it. I don't think there should be any confusion there. We have a particular additional incentive for low cost housing. And in order for this incentive to work, we have proposed a rental charge of 1%, which we think is a reasonable, it's sort of losses related. That needs some clarification. In the case of a freestanding house, the land will be included there because when we calculated the value of the freestanding house, the land wasn't included. But when you do the rental calculation, you have to include the value of the land. That is true. There's also the question of adjusting it, and obviously that's important. So the rental would be adjusted by a measure like the CPI or any similar measure over time. The 200 and the 250, that also will have to be reviewed over time and adjusted accordingly. We don't have a problem with that, but accept that. Then an important issue that was raised was in one particular dimension of these proposals where employers sell their property to their employees, then the possibility of a fringe benefit tax that might undo what we're trying to do. We've noted that, but it's a bit beyond the scope of the bill, and we will have a look at it in the next slide.
Turning now to the government and business licenses. And there were a number of issues around that. The issue that we're talking about here is this. If you pay an ongoing license fee, that's deductible as part of your trade. That's in case law. If, as part of that license, you have ongoing social commitments, that's also part of the case law, that's fine. What we're talking about here is when you acquire a license, there's costs associated with that acquisition. And that comes up in particular areas, such as mining, comes up in telecommunications, that comes up with the gaming. What we're talking about is giving relief for that, saying that if you acquire that license, then you've got to amortize the cost of acquiring that license over the period of the license. That is consistent with accounting, essentially. What came up and what was partially intended originally in the bill was about social expenditure. That oftentimes the department involved doesn't require a fee, but they require a set-aside on behalf of the community. So it could be whatever amounts, it could be oftentimes it's for schooling, and schooling-related items. So if you want this license to cost you $50 million, but you don't pay $50 million to the government, you pay $50 million to various schools to buy the various equipment and so forth. And there was a question of clarity that would you be allowed to have that social expenditure? And we said yes. I think that was always the intention of the amendment, to say to the extent that social expenditure was required to obtain the license, that should be advertisable. But there was also another number of requests coming around the charters themselves, and it's called getting charter points. And that what was requested was, anytime I'm searching for a charter point, I should be able to get that added to my tax benefit. And we felt that was going too far at this stage, because the charter points are fairly loose. A lot of that really is dealing with donations, and that raises a whole set of other issues. And so what we've done is we've narrowed basically the amendment. It should only be for requirements to get the license, not basic charter points. Now, in the case of mining, the charter is a requirement for getting the license. So therefore, that would be acceptable. But for other charters, they're not a requirement for obtaining the license. That's that. In order to further clarify the amendment, we're keeping the social expenditure limited to the area of mining, telecommunications, and gaming. So that's essentially the amendment, and I think that was the target that was aimed at. There are other issues around permissible government spheres. What happens if I don't pay the government, but I pay a regulatory PFMA entity? That should be treated the same. That's an arm of government. We agree, and that one was intended. So that will also receive the same benefit. There are a number of smaller amendments around perpetual licenses. The taxpayer said, look, if I want an exclusivity fee, i.e., that not only am I getting the license to operate, but I'm the only one who can operate in this area, I should get the benefit. Now, that's not a requirement for doing business. That's a requirement for doing business, say, better than somebody else, or excluding somebody else. That issue is a subject for a later discussion. The last issue that comes into play is, let me see, to make sure which one I thought I had. Is there any more license? Hold on. One was an interesting one around effective dates. Here is an example. There are other ones here, but we put it in as well. And that was, they wanted an effective date dated before the amendment, 1 January 2008, because it helped them. And we said, no. Now, you'll see that a number of times throughout this, there are little, whatever it helps the taxpayer, please go back a few years. Now, sometimes we understand that there was some weirdness that happened in the amendments, maybe, but it was just an example of one. That is not acceptable. I think those are the big issues that come around the license. I don't see any other ones that are there. And we can move on to the industrial policy project.
On page 30, the chair needs a few comments with respect to the industrial policy incentive. And this is really a tax incentive regime intended to support the DTI's industrial policy action plan. The question was, why are we not giving extra points, or it's not completely in line with the sectors as listed in the industrial action plan. We've tried to align this incentive as much as possible. Obviously, we can't align it to the T with what is in there, because what is in there is so broad, you can't accommodate everything. And we think trying to restrict the specific sectors would not be feasible, and it would undermine certain objectives of a broad-based an incentive regime that tries to look at certain market failures. So that is not accepted. But then for certain upgrades and expansion, we've got a 25% rule. And there was a question, if the 25% is more than the 200 million that we have for greenfields, why do we discriminate against them? And that was never the intention, and so we will clarify that that is the 25% is not for the gross efforts of the company as a whole, but it will be the assets were specific to that project. And even if that project is so big that the 25% rule doesn't apply, we will also look at that. Then there was a bit of confusion about the energy efficiency criteria. This is not a broad-based incentive for energy efficiency across the board. This is specifically to manufacturing sector, where energy efficiency will be one of the elements in the scoring, which will be released as part of the regulations, which we will publish later this year for comment. Then there was a comment by Deloitte on the possibility of extending this benefit to used equipment that is imported. And they say that can fast-track certain type of investment. We're a bit cautious there, because the whole intention here is to encourage investment and also to look at the competitiveness of the industry and to try and accommodate that, we look at the latest technologies, upgrading the competitiveness of the market, of the manufacturing sector, and to allow for second-hand equipment would probably undo that objective. Okay.
Most of these amendments are fairly straightforward. I'm just going to try to hit the highlights. The biggest one was the rules that apply with the basic purpose of biodiversity is as follows. You have a management agreement. You enter into a management agreement where you agree to forego the use of your land for the benefit of wildlife and so forth. And that, oddly enough, is not easy to do. You've got to get rid of alien vegetation, and it's actually not a thing where you can just sit on the land. And what we intended was that cover all forms of protected areas. And the legislation accidentally excluded parks and natural reserves. So that was clearly wrong. And if you're maintaining, you own the land and it's a national park or reserve, that is fully deductible. And that was accepted. There were some other smaller amendments. One of the bigger ones that was suggested was sometimes you're giving away 99%, 99-year use of the land. So you're giving the land away and the right of use of the land away, not permanently, but for such a long period of time, that we do give you a deduction for that. We say, look, if you're giving away most of the use of the land, you can get a deduction for most of the use of the land. But that is as a donation. The concern was raised that the donation is a 10% limit, that once you move beyond the 10%, that you're not allowed to get the deduction anymore. And that's a general rule for donations we have across the board. The reason we have that is when people make donations, they're getting a deduction, which is effectively say they choose where government money goes instead of government. Now, to some extent, you kind of want to encourage that, but on the other hand, you don't want taxpayers to say, okay, we're going to decide where all of our tax money goes. There are things that they may not like or that they do like, but you know, they want somebody else to pay for it. So what we have is a 10% rule across the board, and they wanted a waiver to that rule. We said, look, that's a very big issue. That's got to be done across the board, and so that has to be revisited at a later stage. I think that's the bulk of the larger amendments that are there. The only other one that came up was they wanted the tax system to choose the priority areas. That priority should be chosen by the tax system. We said, look, that's really the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. The management agreements are set by them. Let them choose their priorities. We're just trying to make sure to provide the according to the tax relief. I think that's one of the reasons for that.
Value-added tax. Most of the issues here are relatively small and technical. The one key one, the two key ones on page 33, essentially what we're doing is we're allowing small businesses or very small businesses that are coming out of the normal tax system, out of the VAT system, and into the presumptive tax system, a break on what is called the VAT exit charge. Now, normally when you leave the VAT system, you have to account for the VAT inputs that you've made, or assets that you still have on hand. Well, these taxpayers who are transitioning from one system to another, we're allowing them essentially just over 100,000 rands worth of credit that they do not have, or exit charge that on assets that they do not have to pass. Now, the question is, why is it only for people who are transitioning from one system to the other? And the answer to that is really we're just trying to make sure that there's as few obstacles as possible for people who wish to make use of very small business taxes. Then there was another interesting one, which was, could we please backdate the increase of the VAT threshold from 300,000 rand to 1 million rand? And the answer to that is no. I mean, most people have worked on the fact that the threshold is the 300,000 rand. To try and retrospectively change that would cause all kinds of interesting problems. And we would point out that when SARS became aware of the fact that some people were confused, we put out a media statement just confirming to everyone that no, it hasn't changed, it will change probably in 2009. So I mean, we certainly played the game from our side to make sure that there wasn't any confusion. If anyone's still confused, they're not reading the papers and they're not reading the VAT news that we send them either. Moving along to customs, relatively small number of comments on customs. This is quite an important one. It deals with buying commissions. We've proposed what we thought was a relatively small amendment that would say that when you work with an invoice, you do not take account of buying commissions. Now, why would we want to do that? Well, if you think about it, the invoice comes from the supplier. The person who is acting as your agent to buy the goods on your behalf is not associated with the supplier, and so shouldn't be putting buying commissions on the supplier's invoice. So it just didn't make sense to have that there. Now, that seems to have created some confusion, and so we'll try and clarify that with the people who raised it in the explanatory memorandum.
Yeah, the clause by clause of the HC one, I think, is pretty small. I think the two bigger ones, page 34 and 35, is the research and development expenses. In February, the way the research and development expenses works is if you undertake R&D, you get 150% deduction. And there are special rules where if Party A funds Party B. So, if the rule is designed to say, look, if I fund another party to do the research, I'll get the 150% deduction, not the party doing the research. Now, what happens is that sometimes you'll have the person who's funding an exempt taxpayer, such as a foreigner. Now, we want to say, well, a foreigner is funding, that the 150% deduction is not lost, the actual person doing the research will get the 150% deduction. And we made that rule work in the early part of this year, and then we forgot about the rule and wrote something over it, and we eliminated the rule, and so what we are doing is we're restoring what we did back in February. So that's equitable correction, the technical correction. So we just forgot what we did. Basically, that's fine. There was also some issues around corporate conversions. What we basically felt that under the law that none of these rules were necessary, that the changes were so small they didn't trigger tax events, but people still wanted it in the law anyway, specifically say they're not a tax event. So restoring the words as they were, and bottom line is they're not tax events. So that's that. Stamp duty, I don't know if you want to take that one, or you missed even on one. I don't want you to take that one.
Right. Keith obviously would like me to take the closing. Stamp duty. Essentially what we have is a proposal which is very similar to something that existed in the stamp duty, the heading is stamp duty, but it should in fact be securities transfer tax. This is something that is similar to a concession we had in the stamp duty system. We've said that if your stamp duty over the period of month comes to less than 100 Rand, you don't take your account for your SARS. It's essentially a de minimis, so that you don't waste your time, you don't waste SARS' time. The suggestion was, well, why can't we do that for 100 Rand per transaction? Well, now that's something very, very different, and so we have respectfully declined that proposal. Because as you can imagine, 100 Rand per transaction for a tax that is at 0.25% can translate to some very big transactions once you start adding them all together. Now, the more significant point on page 35 was the proposal to change the way the second provisional tax payment is, well, not calculated, but how the penalties are imposed with respect to the second provisional tax payment. Now, the proposal that was originally made was that currently you have two safe harbors in the system. You're supposed to make as accurate an estimate as you can, but no penalties are imposed if you are within one of two safe harbors. The one is if your estimate is equal or greater than your basic amount, which is essentially your taxable income for the last year you assessed, or you're within 90% of your actual taxable income for the year. Now, the proposal was to delete the first option, which was reliance on the basic amount. Those basic amounts are frequently outdated. They don't take account of current changes in business. And so the 90% was proposed as your safe harbor. Now, this provoked a very strong reaction. Lots of people were rather unhappy about it and suggested that it was in fact impossible to get to the 90%. And so there was a number of alternatives proposed. I mean, obviously alternative one was don't do anything, and the next alternative was take the basic amount and escalate it by 10% per annum, or 90% is too tight, let's make it 70-75%. Now, we've gone and looked at it again, and although we think some of the difficulties are overstated, we do accept that there is a difficulty in getting to within 90%. And having looked at the numbers that are available to us, we believe that dropping that St. Harvard threshold to 80% should resolve the problem for the vast majority. And that is what we're proposing to the Minister, and this is one of the items that the Minister will have to make full on. We would also point out that even where you fall short of the 80%, if you made a realistic estimate, wasn't, as the quote says on page 36, not deliberately or negligently understated or seriously calculated, there is a provision that the penalty may be waived. So for the exceptional case where something really did come up that you couldn't take account of, you can request the penalty to waive. And then just to wrap up on page 36, the last two items, one of the proposals was that we don't have to publish duplicate rulings for public information. SAICA would like us to publish duplicate rulings. We're not sure why, because these rulings are anonymous. We set out the facts, we set out the law, and we set out how the two interact, and that's the ruling on an anonymous basis. Repeating that every time the similar set of facts and law come up doesn't seem to us to add any value. If we've made a mistake, you'd be able to tell from the first time we made the mistake, not the 15th or 20th time. It's there for people to look at. And then finally, another customs issue relating to the position of use of firearms by selected customs officials. There was a clause which dealt with customs officials being able to use the firearm where there was a threat of imminent or future death. The question arose, well, what's future? Well, that's actually in the existing Criminal Procedures Act. But having thought about it a little harder, we decided that a more modern act had a preferable definition, and that's the Correctional Service Act. And so we've aligned our legislation with what's in that legislation, which specifically talks about self-defense or defense of someone else, which encompasses the imminent danger question and relies on the case law. Chair, that's it from my side.
Thank you. So that was it. Those are the responses. And I just want to check that when you prepared these responses, you probably must have received some submissions after our hearings. See, I've spent responding to some of them, but also haven't had signed off as it is examining the supply of the sun. But there were some that were distributed to us. One was from the NOA, one was from an addition from Bryce Roadhouse. Were those also taken on board? Notable from the NOA one was the issue of the expense formula in Section 21A of the Contempt Act, where they make points to the minister's announcement. I don't know whether I missed your response to that question. If I did, would you want to draw my attention to that response? But also, I would want us to break for tea before we solve the questions. So, we can try ourselves with something. But I just wanted to check whether this actually takes the call. But I would just, heading into the session here. That's something.
That one is just, we've taken into account that document. The issue is around the four funds for the reduction formula. We had originally proposed that we would examine those issues around the four funds. We didn't make a firm commitment on the budget that we'd look at that. There was a whole bunch of issues that began to emerge. Now, the industry wanted certain things, other people wanted other things, and that formula and how the kind of deductions the four funds get is a very complex issue. And while there are a lot of things that the industry is being treated unfairly, there's also some concern that the regime might be overly generous. And that became a major policy issue that went beyond just denouncing an amateur state. And so we have already flagged that issue to the minister to say, look, that we put as an item for consideration for possible legislation. But given what we do, we said we better hold back on this. So no legislation was ever introduced on the issue. We do believe there's a lot of issues around amateurs that have been dealt with, but we never took it up. At this stage, we can't just take up that narrow issue without taking all the others. So that's why we can comment here and see that thing still.
Okay, let's break for tea for 10 minutes, then we'll return and take questions.
So you ate all the sweet and
Okay, members, we've had those responses from the Treasury and Sons to the submissions and comments that were made by other stakeholders. Are there any questions, comments from the committee? Dr. George walked in with a question. We noted your apology earlier that you will be joining us late, and Mr. Asir's hand is up. This is very close to any other comments, questions? If not, let's take those two.
Thank you, Chair. On the electricity levy, we've got the response here, but it seems like that it's already been collected by some of the entities, i.e. municipalities. And my question is that if this is supposed to be the way that it's operating, and secondly, if it starts receiving this money. And then secondly, in terms of bringing the payment date forward that was on the original, or it was the last time we discussed it, I don't see any comment on it. And some of the participants did have some issue with it, so I just want to know, was it discussed, and what was the outcome? Thanks, Chair.
Chair, there was a point on the disability, and I was just checking out the mark, that they are saying that they will look at it in terms, now it was judged on in terms of specific, by saying it's further. What does further mean? It's English. Does it mean during the course of the deal, or 10 years to come, because some other committees are saying it's a year or two in other issues. But with reference to the disability one, it was not clear. Just that better.
Electricity levy, we did present to the committee the last time, and the university's implementation date is the 1st of October. We initially tried the 1st of September because of some practical issues in the 1st of October. We hope we'll make it 1st of October. A few added issues we might have a service ever. We got some information, and maybe it's a problem from our side that we need to communicate this in the press a bit more clearly. We try to communicate as much as possible, but there's some confusion about the implementation date. To the extent that the municipality has started to collect it, they have gone against the law. There's no law that provides for them to collect it. So we heard about this, and we haven't got any confirmation. There's no confirmation in this. I'm in front of the first one to alert me to the Joburg. It's possibly collected the levy already. I asked my other colleagues within Treasury to just check up on this, and they haven't come back to me, and so we'll follow it up.
There's a bit of discussion here. The issue that I think we still have to, and it's really exhausted further than here, is to look up the list. Now, that list would need to be finalized pretty soon. We have already received some comments in a draft sort of outline from one of the organizations.
The list will need to be in place before the lawyers. So essentially, it's going to need to be in place by the 1st of March next year. So that's the time frame. Just on the question of bringing the date forward, interestingly, this didn't seem to elicit a lot of strong opinion on the issue. Where it elicited opinion, it tended to be merged with the provisional tax question of the 90% as the sole safe harbour. We did get one suggestion that a notice period would make sense of at least 14 days. In other words, if the minister is going to invoke this power, we should give people fair notice that he's going to invoke. We accept that comment, and it was a relatively technical one, so we didn't bring it in here. In fact, we are thinking that 30 days notice, we'll have a 3 month to know that there's going to be a change. But there were a couple of I would say low-key questions about it, but there certainly wasn't any strong view on it that we picked up on the submission as a whole. That's why I can say that.
Okay. Any other comments, questions, members? In your responses, you also, when talking about the passive food of companies, you, to a certain extent, you did explain the issue of not accepting the proposal and that a transitional period should be allowed for these companies to unwind. And I thought the submissions were referring to already existing companies. But in your response, you go to the extent of saying that this would create a situation where you know, some kind of an arbitrage situation could arise where people create these companies for the sole purpose of. I'm not too sure how this arises because I thought they were referring to existing ones. But the way you put it is that you open an opportunity for people to establish them for purposes of, you know, getting in and then getting out, taking advantage of the organization. Also in page, that's in page 18, and then in 25, what I would want to see clarity on, you speak about when accepting the issue of the management fee income to be earned by the venture capital fund, it could be allowed, you said it could be allowed within limits. Do you want to share with us which limits exactly? Lastly, on page 27, you refer to on the depreciation allowances for residential units and UDUs. Whilst you note the requirement for occupancy certificates that they have for these problems, especially for old buildings, you say you took the revisited. Do you want to share with the committee? I mean, what exception do you mean by this? What is going to be done?
Yeah, in terms of a passive holding company, when you have a passive holding company, it's not like a company that's a special laborer. It's just like any other company that does certain activities. So if a passive holding company is a company like any other company that generates most of its income from financial instruments, that's what it is. Now, what makes a passive holding company then is not what it is, but what it does. Now, if you give transition relief, the concern is that people will try to look like a passive holding company in the sense that you have a pre-existing company, let's say it has a fair amount of active income and it also has passive income. What they might want to do is suddenly get their passive income to increase. So they become a passive holding company, then they say, aha, I'm a passive holding company, now it's time to liquidate tax-free. So it's like a momentary thing that you would do. Yes, and you move the active business out. The other thing too is, remember, you say, well, I'm going to be a passive holding company. So there's going to be, once you put in that transitional, that's the wording that we have. And again, the other thing is to put a remedy into the case, which I haven't found the case yet. So I need to, you know, after all the emotions, we need to see the actual cases. With the biggest worry they had was the Treasury operation, which I think we're happy to be in percent. Now, I'm sure there are a few people in this room that will show me those cases next year. We'll be back with those narrow amendments. But I frankly don't worry about that so much. Let me just say something about the Certificate of Occupancy. The Certificate of Occupancy is this. In the UDZ regime, in order to get the incentive, you have to do certain reporting requirements. It's a special incentive. We need to have those reporting requirements. The core of those reporting requirements is the Certificate of Occupancy. But when you have a pre-existing business, as Cecil suggested, you don't need one. So this caused some problems. What we're trying to do is find another municipal certificate that's regularly granted that they can rely on. They can't create some new piece of paper. We need something else that's being regularly relied on. The problem is the municipalities will keep asking, give us some other piece of paper that's regularly done that we can rely on that, and they have not been able to come forward with that. So as soon as they can, we will do it, but we need their assistance, and that's what that issue is all about.
Yeah, I mean, the alternative is to scrap it for existing buildings and try and work out something different. But we have to buy with SARS because they left their wallet.
Yes, sir.
On the management fee, I think the idea there is to say that there is a certain expectation that management fee should be X percent. And if it goes beyond that, then the fees are clearly for something different. Now, I don't think we've got a handle on that yet, but you don't want to have other businesses, other fees creeping in, or a management fee that is exorbitant. That is coming
up. Other questions, Mr. Lutz?
Chair, on page 27 and 28, on the rental charge. You're saying that the initial rental charge will be based on 1% of the value of the building plus the value of the land in case of standalone units. I just want to find out, I'm not an expert in this matter, what is the normal valuation methods for buildings? Do you value a building by valuing the land separately and then valuing the building, or you value the whole thing? I'm not clear. Those who are experts in valuation, if you are selling a house, you don't value a house by deconstructing the two and say building separate deconstructing the two and then valuing them separately and coming up to a common value. I mean, if it's a residential property, you just go for property sales and look for the trends. I'm not sure how do we come to this one.
You're right, and I think in the new property rights regime that is exactly what it is. You look at market value, but you must remember previously the municipalities did draw a distinction between improvements and value. So they did value it as considered. What is tried here in the case of residential standalone is that we're going to provide an incentive for low cost housing, and the question is how do you define low cost housing? And we had to come up with a measure. And the easiest one to do was to say cost you to construct a house value at 200,000 or below, that's a low cost house. And it was, if it's an apartment, it's 250 because there you can't really draw a distinction between the big infrastructure and the apartment. But let's stick to the residential one. The challenge that you face here, if you construct a 200,000 house in the center of Cape Town and a 200 house on the flats, the value of their total property will be very different because of the land. And so we say we don't want to draw this discrimination in terms of the cost of the house. Therefore, we took out the land value when we did the initial proposal. But clearly, if you're going to rent it out, you have to take into account the value of the land. You can't ignore the land because you have to pay for the land and develop it. So in calculating the rental charge, don't only look at the construction of the house itself, you look at the total value. That is out there.
Okay, further questions?
If none, then that brings us to the end of this session. And perhaps one would then want to clarify what the process is now going to be. Do you have those issues that you still want to discuss with the minister? Committee would want to afford you the solutions. And we would then have to now look at when we are going to get back and come back to us so that we can then at least do something. So I see here on the program that the kitchen is showing from the show. We have put down Thursday the 25th of September, and it means that we have an adequate opportunity to issue an agreement to us in some form of refinement. Is that okay?
Well, that's fair. I think what we will do, we will give you a written comment on this issue. If there is any particular material difference, obviously, we'll have to then. We don't see it.
Okay, so we will then deal with the matter again on the 25th of September. Thank you very much. I'm informed that the food is moderately healthy lunch at 12. And members of the committee, we thanks Dr. Fiddler and staff. Members of the committee, we meet again tomorrow to deliberate on the draft financial management of Parliament Bill, which I would want us to reach some finality on. But as you would recall, that in terms of the rule of Parliament, we needed to write a letter because that's the proposes an establishment of the committee. We have since listened to the Speaker of Parliament.